Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 26th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's columns come to a head as we review the year and look back at the top stories of 2014. First article, Mercedes-Benz eyes triangle for new headquarters. With New Jersey officials acknowledging that they could lose the U.S. headquarters of Mercedes-Benz, rumors are picking up that the Triangle is among the frontrunners to lure the luxury automaker's headquarters to the southeast. The Detroit News, citing people briefed on the matter, reports that the company is looking at North Carolina's Research Triangle area, as well as Atlanta, as possibilities for its new headquarters in a move that could add nearly 1,000 jobs to a community that lands the project. A decision is expected in early January. Mercedes' U.S. operations have been based in Montvale, New Jersey, near the New York state border since 1972. The Wall Street Journal reports that Mercedes has hired commercial real estate firm JLL to assist in the relocation process. For North Carolina, it could be a second chance at winning over Mercedes-Benz after the automaker, in 1993, passed up a 600-acre site in Mebane for its largest U.S. auto manufacturing facility. That deal eventually landed near Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The Mebane site was said at that time to be the runner-up in a nationally watched bidding war for the luxury car maker. TBJ's, the Triangle Business Journal sister paper, the Atlanta Business Chronicle, has already reported that the company would need about 150,000 square feet of office space for a headquarters relocation. While there are currently no vacant blocks of Class A office space of that size in the Triangle, there are already several Triangle building projects either planned or underway that could fit the German luxury automaker's relocation plans. That list would include Kane Realty Corp's speculative 18-story Tower 2 office building at North Hills in Raleigh that is under construction and slated to open in spring 2016. Kane also has a building site ready to start another office tower, Tower 3, that could rise as much as 28 stories with as much as 450,000 square feet office space, parking, and retail. Raleigh-based Highwoods property would also likely be a contender since the Real Estate Investment Trust has had a number of recent successes in helping win big economic development projects, including MetLife's new Global Technology and Operations Campus coming to Cary. Other development companies like Duke Realty Corporation, Beacon Partners, and Dominion Realty Trust also have sites that are shovel-ready for office expansion in both Wake and Durham County. It came up this year. The News and Observer building is up for sale. The downtown site is prime for redevelopment. The News and Observer confirms it is exploring a sale of its roughly 3.5-acre campus in downtown Raleigh. While publisher Orage Quarles III wouldn't be specific about conversations he's had with potential buyers, he did say that a sale has been talked about for several months. The paper says it is evaluating proposals from developers and that a broker has been hired to assist in vetting buyers for the 3.5-acre site at 215 South McDowell Street. Dominion Realty's Andy Andrews, who is building the Charter Square office project in downtown Raleigh, says the area has economic momentum. "It's a great property that would suit a corporate HQ-type project," says Andrews. "It will take some work with the city. What could go there? Maybe an office building and some apartments. Whatever happens," Andrews estimates, "nothing will begin before 2017. James Sauls, Raleigh's economic development director, agrees that there is great potential for the site. "The site would be perfect for a mixed-use development that could include hotel, office, residential, and parking," he says. "We are in need of all four of these in the downtown district." And the Dune Dogs deliver that old-time swamp and roll. Hundreds of local baby boomers and friends, including many graduates of Broughton High School, crowded into the Southland Ballroom in downtown Raleigh on December 22nd for the 10th annual Dune Dogs Holiday Extravaganza, featuring local bands The Dune Dogs and Midnight Snack. The Dune Dogs features lead vocalist and harmonica player David Finch, president and CEO of Etcom Business Technology Solutions in Durham. The band's rendition of Robert Earl Keane's Merry Christmas from the Family was a highlight, as was a guest appearance by David Burney, Red Hat alum and founder of Raleigh design and marketing firm Newkind, with a rendition of Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues. And no Dune Dogs event would be complete without Southern barbecue and steamed oysters. It's also been confirmed North Carolina has the third largest governor's mansion in the United States. At 30,000 square feet, Governor Pat McCrory's mansion is the third largest in the nation and the second most valuable. Completed in 1891, the Queen Anne-style North Carolina Executive Mansion at 1 East Edenton Street in Raleigh has an estimated value of $8.4 million, according to a recent report by real estate brokerage firm and blog Movado that ranks the 10 biggest governor's mansions in America. Here are the top 10, along with their location, square footage, and Movado's estimated value. Number 1, Illinois in Springfield, 50,000 square feet at $5.4 million. Number 2, Maryland in Annapolis at 38,000 square feet, $7 million. And, of course, our home state, North Carolina, Raleigh at 30,000 square feet, $8.4 million, previously mentioned. Number 4, Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, 28,500 square feet and $3.5 million. Number 5, Colorado, Denver, 26,000 square feet, $7.9 million. Louisiana, Baton Rouge, 25,000 square feet, $2.5 million. Georgia, Atlanta, 24,000 square feet, $8.5 million. Number 8, West Virginia, Charleston, 21,000 square feet at $840,000. Number 9, Wisconsin, Madison, 20,777 square feet at $6.6 million. And at number 10, New York, Albany, 20,000 square feet at $2 million. Amanda Hoyle's column covers commercial and residential real estate. Her top story of 2014 was the North Carolina Commerce Shuffle. The new state economic development partnership launches. The North Carolina Department of Commerce has had a long history of successes in recruiting and landing big investment and jobs projects, regularly ranking among the most competitive and most effective deal-making agencies in the nation by Site Selection magazine and others. Yet, after the state lost 5% of its payroll employment base in the 2 years following the economic recession, was still suffering a 9.5% unemployment rate by the time Republican Governor Pat McCrory took office in 2013. He challenged new Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker to fix it. The solution that she and others came up with was to create a public-private partnership for the Commerce Department that would completely upend the way that North Carolina has recruited new industry in the past. The plan would transfer most of the sales and marketing functions, as well as its power of negotiation with companies, to a private entity that would still get state funds. While authorization of grants would remain under Commerce Department authority, the staff of the new Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina could work independent of many of the state's policies, such as for travel expenses and public disclosure. My experience of a year in public life is that it is very different in that government setting to make fast decisions, Decker was quoted as saying in January 2014. The partnership would also be structured so that recruiters were motivated by bonuses for success and possible dismissal for failure. Critics say such a model could make it harder to track public expenditures and could open new doors to cronyism. While the General Assembly was debating the bill that would create and fund the new partnership, the governor-appointed Economic Development Board, chaired by Charlotte businessman John Lasseter, unveiled its North Carolina Jobs Plan. The 28-page jobs plan document, created after 6 months of study, will serve as a roadmap for economic development initiatives over the next 10 years, including the types of companies the state should be targeting for job creation and policy change recommendations that could speed corporate executives' decisions to invest and expand in the state. Shortly thereafter, Decker announced she hired Raleigh business consultant Richard Lindemuth as the partnership's interim chief executive to lead it through the transition, using the job's plan as his guide. Lindemuth will be replaced as CEO in January 2015 by Chris Chung, currently the CEO of a similarly established public-private economic development partnership in Missouri. In June, McCrory signed the bill into law allocating $17.5 million annually to the partnership once it met other private funding thresholds. As of October 2014, the partnership had raised $440,000 from five companies, including Duke Energy, Red Hat, and Lenovo. John Lasseter has stayed involved in the transition, serving as chairman of its interim board and now chair of its newly appointed 17-member board that includes corporate executives from across the state. The Economic Development Partnership and its initial staff of about 35, most of whom are former Commerce Department employees, moved into their new office on Weston Parkway in Cary on October 6th, and the transition so far seems to be going smoothly. Secretary Decker announced in December that with the transition mostly complete, she will step out of her role in state government on December 31st to return to the private sector. John Sclavara III, leader of the State Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, has been named her successor. Next up, Durham poised for major downtown redevelopment. Downtown Durham has had several big new building projects break ground and open over the last year, but one of the most ambitious projects to date is the Durham Innovation District, or Durham ID, development plan along Morris Street that could bring hundreds of new workers and residents to the north end of downtown Durham over the next decade. Early plans for the district, which Boston-based Longfellow Real Estate Partners launched in October, show sketches for buildings that could total more than 1.3 million square feet of new office and lab space, multifamily housing, and room for retail and restaurants. The buildings represent about a $300 million investment. What makes this project different from other plans that have fizzled across the region is the cash of the team that Longfellow has assembled. The Durham ID plan already has the full support and a partnership with Duke University. Longfellow invested $100 million over the past 3 years in the purchase and renovation of the 50,000-square-foot research lab building on Main Street and the 115,000-square-foot Carmichael building on Duke Street, both of which are fully leased to Duke University as office and research space. Longfellow also has the support of Hank Skerich, founder and president of Durham-based educational testing services company Measurement Incorporated, which owns most of the buildings and 15 acres that comprise the Durham Innovation District, and Skerich already has support from Durham City and business leaders. There's no reason it couldn't be like American Tobacco, Skerich said about the project, comparing it to the $200 million redevelopment of the American Tobacco Historic District by Capital Broadcasting Company on the south side of downtown Durham. Longfellow has the resources to make it happen. Continuing on Amanda Hoyle's columns of commercial and residential real estate news items of 2014, downtown Raleigh rising higher with new projects. There's something about seeing cranes along the downtown Raleigh skyline that makes it feel more alive again, and downtown Raleigh is experiencing a growth spurt that's feeding a need for taller buildings for the first time since the recession. While construction hardly stopped during the recession, much of what was being built was financed by the city and county, like the new Wake County Justice Center building and Red Hat Amphitheater, or it was renovation and expansion of existing structures downtown. This new growth spurt is all about density, and it's money from the private sector that's feeding the fire. In 2014, developers broke ground on multiple office and multifamily building projects that are changing the Raleigh skyline and bringing hundreds of new employees and residents into the downtown district. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance estimates that more than 2,200 new rental units will open by mid-2016. Among the tallest is the $60 million 23-story Sky House apartment tower at the corner of Martin and Blunt Streets. It will add 320 new units when it opens. In February 2015, On the same block, the Edison Apartments will add another 223 residential units to the downtown market when it opens in 2016 spring. On Fayetteville Street, the $63 million Charter Square office high-rise has topped out at 11 stories and will add 243,000 square feet of new Class A office inventory when it opens in May 2015. Charter Square developer Andy Andrews hopes to kick off construction of a 20-story tall sister building in 2015. Citrix also opened its new office complex in September in a fully renovated and expanded warehouse building on West Street that has brought 700 more workers to downtown. Continuing on, Chatham Park to redefine the area, and the population may increase 15-fold. The Pittsburgh Town Board in June made history with 4 out of 5 town commissioners voting to approve the master plan and rezoning of Chatham Park, a 7,120-acre development project in Chatham County being led by Cary-based Preston Development Group. Early projections for Chatham Park show that it could increase the population of Pittsburgh by 60,000 people, more than 15 times the town's current population of 3,800 if it is built out to its full potential over the next 3 decades. Plans include spaces that can accommodate a combined 22 million square feet of commercial space, plus 22,000 residential dwelling units mixed with larger swaths of open space and park areas, some overlooking the nearby Haw River. We talked to probably 25 different groups that want to locate their headquarters here, said Tim Smith, a partner at Preston Development. Preston Development in December celebrated the groundbreaking of the first building, a 25,000-square-foot medical office building that will be operated in partnership with UNC Hospitals of Chapel Hill. The hospital system has also expressed interest in expanding a major facility at Chatham Park. The project will remain under the microscope of critics who worry that dense development of the Chatham Park land will pollute the nearby rivers and creeks that feed into Jordan Lake. A lawsuit filed by the opposition group Pittsburgh Matters challenging the town's rezoning approval, as well as a countermotion questioning Pittsburgh Matters' legal standing, are still pending in court. And there's an RTP revival, rebranding and expanding the Research Triangle Park. The foundation that manages Research Triangle Park in early 2014 took an important first step toward its master plan goals to bring in more companies, more density, and more amenities for RTP employees. Its acquisition of the 100-acre Park Center office park on Davis Drive for $17 million, as well as the old Radisson Hotel a few months prior, was lauded by the real estate and business community. Most of the 9 major buildings within Park Center built in the 1980s for IBM had been vacant for years. A shame for a property so near the epicenter of RTP's 7,000-acre footprint at the intersection of Davis Drive and NC 54, just down the street from the Research Triangle Foundation headquarters. The foundation has so far demolished 2 of the park's oldest buildings, the Radisson Hotel and the 50 Park Drive office building. The 800 Park Drive building, the largest building within the campus, was named for Frontier Communications, which announced in October it will be connecting it with high-speed gigabit internet service, as well as the other Park Center buildings as they are renovated. RTP has also secured several major lease commitments for tenants ready to take space in the 800 Park Drive building, including the Army Research Center, Entradot, and several others. The foundation is planning an unveiling event for the new development plan for Park Center in mid-January. Jason DeBruin's column on healthcare and biopharmaceuticals leads with GSK's 900-person layoff that shakes the RTP site. Earlier this month, drug giant GlaxoSmithKline announced it will lay off 900 Research Triangle Park workers in research and development, transfer hundreds to a subunit of contract research organization ParaXL, and consolidate North American R&D operations in Philadelphia. A GSK spokeswoman didn't mince words. In making the announcement, she said the R&D operations in the Research Triangle Park will be greatly reduced from the roughly 2,500 employees there today. In all, GSK employs about 4,300 in the triangle, including more than 900 workers at its Zebulon facility in Wake County. RTP is GSK's largest site in North Carolina. While this was far from my favorite story of the year, not even a hardened journalist likes to see 900 workers lose their jobs. It was certainly the most important pharmaceutical story facing the Triangle in 2014. I've been calling GSK and its predecessors the godfather of the Triangle's pharmaceutical industry, and I think it's an appropriate title. Former employees of Glaxo Incorporated, Glaxo Welcome, and finally GlaxoSmithKline are all throughout the Triangle, and the startup pharmaceutical industry here would not be thriving as it is without the heft that GSK brought here. Indeed, those alumni who helped more than 350 research and development companies, 120 research companies, and 100 manufacturing companies thrive in the state. While those companies are good potential landing spots for these laid-off workers, it also highlights the point that cuts at GSK, particularly in research and development. It hurts in more ways than just the sheer numbers. We are disappointed to hear GSK's announcement, though we know it reflects the realities that global pharmaceutical companies are facing, says Doug Edgton, president and CEO of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. GSK's ancestor, Burroughs Wellcome, was an early recruit to North Carolina and served as a cornerstone in the region's rapid life science growth. Layoffs will begin in the first quarter and carry on throughout the year. Contract research organization ParaXL could hire as many as 450 of the displaced GSK workers, but those details have yet to be worked out. These layoffs don't cripple the pharma industry here, far from it, but it will certainly slow the growth in this area that had enjoyed and could result in a minor brain drain, depending on how many of these affected workers must move out of the area to find employment. Next up, LabCorp LipoScience deal. LabCorp's acquisition of LipoScience at half the 2013 market value. In the late 1990s, an NC State University spin-out held strong promise that it could develop a healthcare test that gives patients a better indication of their risk of having a heart attack. That company became LipoScience, and on January 25, 2013, company executives and investors watched as the company's shares went public for $9 apiece. Soon, the shares surged past $11, plotting a market value of the company in excess of $170 million. Unfortunately, none of that would last long. Exactly 21 months later, the medical device company that manufactures blood tests was sold for $85 million to Laboratory Corporation of America, its biggest customer. The price was less than half the company's market value shortly after the IPO. Factoring in cash, the deal was even lower at about $63 million. This was another hard story to report, but another one important as it serves as a warning sign to the dozens of other life science companies in the area that look like they have a promising product but for various reasons can't break through and find success. LipoScience's failure is but one small example of a trend happening throughout the healthcare industry. Its biggest failure was not in the diagnostic test itself, but that it could not convince health insurance companies to cover the test. The 2010 American College of Cardiology Foundation and the American Heart Association Guideline for Assessment of Cardiovascular Risk explicitly says these tests are, quote, not recommended for cardiovascular risk assessment in asymptomatic adults, end quote. Because insurers would not cover the test at a favorable rate, patients were faced with an option. Use the LipoScience test and pay high out-of-pocket expenses, or choose a different test and pay little out-of-pocket. Clearly, for many patients, that choice is simple. After the announced acquisition, LipoScience disclosed that it's attempted to sell itself to as many as a dozen other companies could not garner as much as an offer. LabCorp, a company with $5.8 billion in 2013 revenue, completed the acquisition on November 21st. Still on the healthcare and biopharmaceuticals column, 2014 was a roller coaster year for Raleigh-Salix. In the first half of 2014, Raleigh-Salix Pharmaceuticals seemed to benefit from its 2013 acquisition of Centaurus. An inversion deal was reached with a foreign company that would allow it to move headquarters overseas and reduce taxes. The share price really got hot after rumors that Salix was a potential takeover candidate of Botox maker Allergan, which was trying to stave off an acquisition of Valeant Pharmaceuticals. That came crashing down on November 7th when Salix shares dropped 35% and the company lost nearly $3 billion in market value overnight, as it reported operating losses and raised questions about inventory reporting that ultimately led to an audit and later a shareholder lawsuit. The ongoing audit examines inventory levels of Salix's gastrointestinal drugs. For months, executives at Salix led investors and analysts to believe that the wholesaler inventory of its drugs held steady at roughly 10 weeks to 12 weeks, when in fact inventory was as high as 36 weeks for some drugs. Salix CFO Adam Derbyshire resigned hours before Salix CEO Carol Logan reported third quarter results. The audit is ongoing, and Salix shares had rebounded to about $106 per share by mid-December after falling as low as $91. The high in mid-September was nearly $173 per share. Continued dark news for 2014 in the pharmaceutical area. Medicaid reform bogs down in General Assembly and frustrating the physicians. During the short session this summer, state lawmakers left some unfinished business as it relates to health care, Medicaid. Governor Pat McCrory put out a Medicaid reform plan developed by North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Aldana Wass. It was broadly supported by hospitals, physicians, and the House, but the Senate wanted something different. Medicaid is the taxpayer-funded program that provides health insurance to the poor and needy. The roughly $13 billion program receives two-thirds of its funding from the federal government. The North Carolina Senate has proposed a plan that would bring managed care organizations, possibly from outside the state, to manage the Medicaid population. Depending on how many would enter the state, the plan would place more of a regulatory burden on practice and would hit small practices especially hard. Right now, you have one set of Medicaid hoops to jump through, says Gregory Griggs, Executive Vice President of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. If we go to this 3, 4, 5 managed care plans, these small practices are just going to be buried under paperwork. Conversely, the plan proposed by Governor McCrory and supported by the House would introduce more of an accountable care organization model in which practices take part in managing the Medicaid population. Although doctors and lawmakers in the House seemed confident months ago that the governor's plan would pass, stalemate has grated on some physicians. We would have thought that this idea would have been put to bed by now, says Griggs. And a little bright news on this column from Jason DeBruin. It's been a pivotal year for the Carolina Hurricanes. Saying the Carolina Hurricanes stumbled out of the gate this year would be putting it kindly. The hockey team went 0 for November, digging themselves such a deep hole that various prediction metrics gave the team between a 1% and 2% chance of even making the playoffs. The Canes last made the playoffs in 2009, but since then have had a record of 176-181-47. A record that, in a state where college basketball rules supreme, this isn't enough to keep fans coming to the games. The team doesn't divulge exact ticket sales, although before the season, team president Don Waddell spoke frankly about the state of ticket sales revenues. He says, "It's been a tough summer, you know. We're having a hard time with ticket sales and sponsorship sales, which is not surprising. To try to boost sales, the team will more than triple its sales team to 30. Keeping a positive outlook, Waddell said in mid-December, the addition of personnel in the coming year or two will benefit our business. Since 2009, the Canes have seen a shifting revenue makeup that increasingly relies on shared revenue from television contracts. In 2009, the team generated $37 million from admissions and $5 million from suite sales for some 36% of the team's $115 million revenue that year. Fast forward to last year, when the Hurricanes generated about $22 million from admissions and $2.9 million from suite sales, or about 23% of total revenue. By comparison, shared revenue from the NHL and TV contracts in 2009 contributed $34 million to the top line. By the end of the 2013-14 season, the NHL and the TV contract contributed $50 million to revenue a 47% increase from the 2009 and nearly twice what the team generated from ticket and suite sales. And now a little bit brighter news from Lauren Onisorge covering technology and entrepreneurship. The top story in 2014 from her column is the Lenovo-IBM deal, where Lenovo's U.S. expansion benefits the RTP brand. January 2014 was anything but typical for Lenovo, which decided to go on a bullish $5 billion shopping spree. The company, which already had what it called a dual headquarters in Morrisville, made two back-to-back announcements. First, that it would be buying IBM's Research Triangle Park-based server division, a move that would double its presence in North Carolina. Next, it announced it would be buying Chicago-based Motorola Mobility for $2.9 billion. When the first deal closed on October 1st, employees began trekking from IBM to Lenovo's newly leased RTP campus, formerly occupied by Ericsson. To close this acquisition, we have worked closely, securing approvals with a number of regulatory authorities, said CEO Yuan Qing Yang. These successful reviews are even more proof that Lenovo is a transparent and reliable global company. The deal helps propel the company down a clear path to reach a lofty goal, to be a profitable $5 billion company in 1 year, Yang added. We're committed to ultimately winning and becoming number one in the server market worldwide, just as we have worldwide in PCs, says Jay Parker, president of Lenovo North America. The server deal, which ultimately closed for $2.1 billion, continues to impact the triangle. Employees are officially integrated into the new RTP campus, and execs say they're taking advantage of the brand awareness they've built this holiday season. Lenovo execs say to expect more community involvement and more winning in 2015. In the meantime, at Big Blue, a battle is brewing. IBM CEO Ginni Rometty addressed investors directly in October after disappointing earnings and offered no apologies for recent offloads, including that of the server business. "We need to deploy that capital to other things," she says. "Instead of focusing on hardware, IBM, which once had 10,000 employees in RTP, is focusing on other areas such as big data, cloud, and mobile computing. Our company is fundamentally better positioned than it was a few years ago," Rometty said, "but we have more to do, and we have to do it." Also this year, a power move for Raleigh and NC State University. President Barack Obama was in Raleigh in January announcing a $140 million consortium that would be based in North Carolina, specifically at NC State University. Truly an international effort, the Department of Energy-funded consortium, dubbed the Next Generation Power Electronics Innovation Institute, spans the globe from Germany to California to Taipei with two big common denominators: the drive to create a more efficient power device and a Raleigh home base. Statements to the press said at the time that 1,000 new jobs would come out of the center with 18 corporate partners, including Cree, ABB, and GridBridge. While an interim director for the center, Dennis Kikos, has been selected, it's been slow going. "Although we're moving forward and the progress hasn't stopped, I can say that I think initially we've hoped to be moving at a very quick pace," says Chad Eckert, CEO of GridBridge, via recent conversation. He and the rest of the partners hope things move quicker in 2015. Continuing on, Lauren Onisorge's column of technology and entrepreneurship. A hot story in 2014 was HCL to bring 1,237 new jobs to Cary. It started with a leaked document from the town of Cary in July. A company, no one would confirm which, was considering bringing 1,237 jobs to Cary and hunting incentives. The rumor mill churned. In September came the big reveal. Indian IT services company HCL Technologies, which already had more than 800 employees in the triangle, was the mystery company. The firm was approved for up to $19.6 million in state incentives to bring in those jobs in the next 5 years, which execs said will have an annual average wage of $51,653. Months later, HCL announced it was expanding into a second building, and progress is already being made. HCL has already hired more than 100 of those positions, according to Rajiv Suhaid, Senior Corporate Executive Vice President and Chief Productivity and Competitiveness Officer. And hiring will continue in 2015 as employees continue to move into the new building. Sodhai says the idea is to take it floor by floor. So far, employees have moved into the first floor. This is a long-term investment, he says. Execs say the Cary campus is HCL's big play in the United States. Depending on what happens here, the company could then expand to other regions of the country. Next up, major acquisitions. Triangle Tech companies entice suitors for big exits. In November, Durham-based app marketeer Appia became the latest Triangle exit story as Mandalay Digital purchased the firm for $100 million in stock, options, and debt. A huge part of why Mandalay wants to acquire Appia is for the team, says Judd Bowman, CEO of Appia. Mandalay, which is changing its name to Digital Turbine, presents a people-friendly exit, says Bowman. And it was just one of the Triangle's big tech exit stories. California tech giant Informatica purchased Cary-based data-as-a-service firm Strike Iron for $54.6 million in June. Strike Iron provides the kind of technology that allows pizza delivery firms to remember your address when you place an online order, and Time Warner Cable to send you a message when a technician is en route. Over the past couple of years, it's been licensing its own platform, not just providing technology services, all enticing factors to big tech companies. And in Durham, cloud service from Digital Smiths snagged acquisition headlines in January when it was snatched up by TiVo for $135 million. TiVo officials said at the time that it meant a significant expansion in market opportunity and that Digital Smiths would retain independence in Durham. According to Digital Smiths co-founder Ben Weinberger, TiVo kept its word. And Triangle Fiber Wars. February brought a big tease to the Triangle as Google announced it had selected the Research Triangle Park, Raleigh-Durham area as a possible expansion site for its buzzed-about Google Fiber service. The high-speed service would allow users to access the web at speeds of up to 100 times faster than basic broadband. And like dominoes, other fiber players soon gnawed their way to the headlines. Shortly after the Google announcement, Shelby-based RST Fiber and AT&T both announced plans to bring high-speed fiber to the Triangle. And this fall, Frontier Communications became the first to offer the service to residential customers in parts of Durham. While RST Fiber packed up its equipment and headed to Charlotte, with its CEO unsure of when specifically RST will be back, AT&T announced in December that its fiber service was live in parts of the Triangle, including Raleigh and Cary. That happened through a partnership with the university-driven initiative, North Carolina Next Generation Network. Though further expansions are anticipated, no time frame was given for further rollouts. RST applied for additional permits in Wake Forest in November, signaling that they, too, may make a solid commitment in 2015. Google has said its Triangle plan would involve the cities of Carrboro, Cary, Chapel Hill, Durham, Garner, Morrisville, and Raleigh. Execs also said an announcement will happen before the end of the year. In December, the company said an announcement would happen in January. Well, folks, I got to tell you, there are so many stories in this week's The Triangle Business Journal about what happened in 2014, I might not get to all of them, but we'll continue with Dawn Wallace's column covering small business, personalities, and Triangle trends. Her top story was the RDU Terminal 1. In 2012, Raleigh-Durham International Airport began the $68 million renovation of the Terminal 1, which opened this spring. Because the airport is a key component of the Triangle's connectivity to the global marketplace, and because it plays a major role in attracting companies to the area, its expansion and upgrades rose to the top of the year's transportation-related stories. Five of the terminal's nine gates are occupied by Southwest Airlines. But RDU's Terminal 1 provides not only connectivity through Southwest's five gates, but also provides the airport with its flexible growth opportunities. Currently, the remaining gates aren't set to be filled at any given time. The airport will keep the gates until a carrier seeks to expand at RDU. The terminal's current capacity of 3.1 million accounts for about one-third of the airport's annual passengers has hovered around 9.1 million for the past 4 years. The outcome of millions of dollars spent over 2 years is a modern first glance at the triangle when passengers come from other states, and little remains to be done. Passenger traffic flows through the building from street level up to the stairs to security and through to the concourse where passengers arrive and head downstairs to the baggage claim, passing life-size iconic art depicting scenes and maps from around the triangle. With the completion of Terminal 1, the Airport Authority ended a 15-year, nearly $1 billion program that saw the transformation of the airport with new terminals, parking garage, and general aviation facilities, says RDU CEO Michael Langeth. Now we turn our attention to maintaining these world-class facilities as we poise ourselves for the future, with a focus on the development of international air service. RDU is moving forward with the final phase of the Terminal 1 construction, the tear-down of what's left of the old building. The first section was constructed in 1955, and the remaining north and south concourse demolition is estimated to cost between $6 million and $7 million. You'd never know it, but Raleigh hopes to build on a Bluegrass Festival success. The International Bluegrass Music Association's World of Bluegrass Festival left cramped quarters in Nashville, Tennessee last year to spread its vibes through the streets of downtown Raleigh, drawing a record crowd 2 years in a row. Earlier this year, IBMA announced it would be returning to Raleigh for an additional 3 years. In 2013, the festival, with its ticketed portion in the Red Hat Amphitheater, its business conference in the Raleigh Convention Center, and its full-on street ramble along Fayetteville Street, drew 150,000 people over the course of 5 days. But it exploded to 180,000 people this year, bringing $10.8 million to the city in an estimated direct spending by the calculations of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. The growing popularity of the bluegrass music, along with the positive praise last year events received, helped to drive home the message with those outside of Wake County that World of Bluegrass was an event worth traveling for, says Lauren Gold, Executive Vice President of the Bureau. Our figures estimate that there was a 5% increase from 84,000 out-of-town visitors in 2013 to 88,000 in 2014, Gold says. The numbers show that Raleigh has recently grown into a festival destination, bringing street fillers such as Hopscotch, and even events such as Brugaloo and the Food Truck Rodeo, which filled up downtown, further compound the fact that Fayetteville's street structure and ability to shut down make it optimal for fun. But the biggest show by far is the World of Bluegrass, and after 3 years, other destinations will be heavily considered as new fiddling grounds. Top contenders for the show include Lexington, Kentucky, Knoxville, Tennessee, and Branson, Missouri. Among the issues Raleigh organizers will have to address are available hotel space, walkability, and parking. Dawn Wallace continues to cover the top stories of 2014 on small business and triangle trends with solar energy. Strata Solar invests $1 billion in North Carolina solar farms. This year, the Chapel Hill-based solar farm producer Strata Solar has set up more than 60 solar farms across 40 counties in rural North Carolina, closing in on $1 billion invested in solar in the state. The company has approached breakneck speed, bringing a new solar farm online nearly every 10 days, says John Morrison, Strata Solar's Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Asset Management. Founded in 2009 by Marcus Wilhelm, the company has brought 350 megawatts of solar energy online in the last 5 years, pushing North Carolina to third in the nation for solar installations. The company works as a one-stop shop for solar farms by sourcing the land, designing the project, engineering the work, procuring the metal, the material, and building the solar farm. Strata is able to do this quickly by replicating a template. According to Wilhelm, his company has created work for 2,000 people. Solar energy is a big part of North Carolina's all of the above energy strategy, and we thank Strata Solar for its impressive investment in our state. North Carolina is a national leader in solar energy, and companies like Strata Solar have played a big role in our past and will continue to do so in the future, said Governor Pat McCrory at the company's celebration, reaching the $1 billion investment at the Anderson Solar Farm in Roseboro. The company recently teamed up with National Cooperative Bank and Washington, D.C.-based Sol Systems for financing and investment management, particularly on six recent solar farms, which received around $100 million in investments. By 2016, the company aims to invest another $1 billion in solar power in the state. And we've got some brewery buzz. On Tap, North Carolina Craft Beer Incubated. In May, the American Tobacco Campus and Capital Broadcasting Company quietly set aside an intact mill site and designated it as the state's only craft beer brewery incubator. The Rocky Mount Mills, established in 1818, was the state's second cotton mill. Now the mill village will serve as living quarters for brewery incubators, and spaces within the mill will have enough equipment to be shared by eight nano breweries. The mill sits on the Tar River, just a short drive from Raleigh on U.S. 64. Eastern North Carolina, including Rocky Mount, has struggled economically for quite a long time, says Margot Knight Metzger, executive director of the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild. I think this project has the potential to put Rocky Mount on the map for manufacturing again, as well as make it a bona fide tourism destination. Meanwhile, breweries in Raleigh have sprung up near the Five Points neighborhood between Atlantic and Glenwood Avenues. The cornerstone brewery for the district, although it sits just outside of the neighborhood, is Big Boss Brewing Company at 1249 Wicker Drive, founded in 2006. It was the only brewery in the area until Sub Noir came along in 2012 at 2039 Progress Court. The Nano Brewery is expanding into the space beside it. In September, Nickel Point Brewery Company at 509 Pershing Road joined those breweries, and just down the road at 520 Pershing, Neuse River Brewing Company is preparing its space with no determined opening date as of yet. On Whitaker Mill Road, Blackjack Brewing Company is the newest brewery, moving into a massive 10,000 square foot space, making it one of the largest in the neighborhood. My latest count is 120 breweries open to the public, says Metzger. By the end of the year, we may have a couple more. As it stands, I have 45 breweries in planning on my list to open in 2015 and beyond. And that list keeps growing week by week, so I don't expect a slowdown. The growth is widespread across the state, with lots of action in Charlotte, Raleigh, and Wilmington. Craft beer sales are up 18% nationwide this year, so it's likely that craft breweries will continue to grow in size and number in the Triangle. And let's take a look at Raleigh's local retail scene. Small businesses in downtown Raleigh have seen ups and downs over the years, especially during the recent recession, but 2014 was a promising year for new local retailers. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance releases quarterly reports on how many businesses opened and closed, and by the second quarter of 2014, the group showed no businesses closing and 11 new street-level businesses opening, for a net gain of more than 150 new street-level businesses opening since 2008. As it stands now, 10 street-level businesses have opened during the third quarter, bringing the total for 2014, as of December 22nd, to 29 new businesses. These businesses include soft goods, hair salons, craft beer shops, and restaurants. While it sounds like good news, the rotation of downtown businesses hasn't yet returned to pre-recession numbers. In 2008, 45 businesses opened and 20 closed. In 2009, 39 shops opened and 24 shops closed. The number of closings continued to grow until 2012, when there were just 17. But the number of opening businesses has declined since its peak of 54 in 2010 until now. This year, 10 businesses have closed at street level so far. That's three more than last year. Downtown Raleigh Alliance Planning and Development Manager Bill King chalks it up to growing pains. Some closings are part of the growing pains of downtown revitalization, where building owners may want a new concept in their street-level space, as more activity in downtown occurs and they imagine a new use for their ground floor, says King, who adds that others close simply due to internal issues. They've missed the boat, however, of what King calls the new wave of residents and office workers flowing into downtown. Currently, more than 1,800 residential units are under construction downtown, a silent promise of foot traffic for already established businesses. This week's guest column in the Viewpoint page of the Triangle Business Journal is written by John Hood, who is the chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. His column is entitled Startups, the Solution to Jumpstart Economy. The U.S. economy continues to recover from the depths of the Great Recession, and North Carolina continues to recover at a faster rate than the national average. But few would describe the trend as impressive by historical standards. Consider just one statistic. Average income per person. Since Barack Obama took office, it's risen 1% after adjusting for inflation. Compared to the 11% increase in per capita income during the same share of the Reagan presidency and 8% growth during the same share of the Clinton presidency. That's underwhelming. No wonder most Americans still express disappointment about the recent past and pessimism about the near future. Economists may not agree about much, but there is a growing consensus that a decline in entrepreneurship may be one explanation for the economy's lackluster performance. During the 1980s and 90s, more new businesses were created. Some succeeded, many failed. The ones that succeeded, however, created an outsized share of new jobs, which in turn benefited not only those filling the new jobs, but also workers in other industries and consumers of the goods and services the new companies produced. In a recent edition of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, several scholars examined the issue at length. There are probably multiple causes for the decline in entrepreneurship, including trends in international commerce and the aging of the workforce. Another is public policy. Starting a business is inherently a risky endeavor. To the extent that government actions increase the baseline risk by setting up costly barriers to opening new firms, for example, fewer entrepreneurs will be willing to assume it. In their paper, Harvard Business School professors William Carr, Ramanananda, and Matthew Rhodes Croft recommended that policymakers pursue a careful consideration of the broader regulatory framework, including labor laws and requirements with which new entrants need to comply, with a focus on how they affect incentives for entry. These efforts to structure a better playing field are admittedly less glamorous than announcing a new biotech cluster initiative, but they are far more likely to have sustained effects. End quote. Here in North Carolina, the General Assembly has made great strides in the past 4 years in reforming the regulatory process. During the 2015 session and beyond, lawmakers should also rethink the extent to which the state limits entry into new professions. In its Freedom in the 50 States project, George Mason University's Mercatus Center ranks the states on the extent and complexity of licensing regulation. North Carolina ranks 39th. We license more occupations than the average state, and the rules we impose are often more onerous than those in other states that license the same occupations. We do well to emulate the policies of high-ranked states such as Colorado and Idaho, which also happen to have relatively strong rates of business starts and growth. Carr, Nanda, and Rhodes Croft made a no less compelling point when they observed that governments should be cautious about industrial policies that seek to minimize business failures, as such policies may only be propping up firms that need to fail. Businesses start and job creation occurs when the economy is churning, when the pressures of competition and innovation reveal some companies and products to be inefficient or obsolete, opening the door to new ways for organizing people and resources to meet changing consumer demands. Other public policies that keep economies from churning include pro-union labor laws, government bailouts during recessions, and incentive grants that tend to favor large incumbent firms over new companies with which they compete for land, labor, or capital. I'm not arguing that North Carolina leaders should favor new firms over old ones, or that they ought to let themselves get dragged into venture capital business through special tax credits or pension fund schemes. They should remove impediments and otherwise stay out of the way. This week's editor's notebook is from Sukada Mukherjee, and he entitles his column this week, Don't Let Mercedes Get Away Again. Here we go again. In 1993, when I was in the early days of my journalism career, I covered the Mercedes-Benz $300 million auto plant project that was going to create thousands of jobs, put the winning city, county on the global map, and jumpstart other economic development projects for the area. Folks at Daimler AG had identified a site in Mebane and a site in Vance, Alabama, for the plant. Alabama won, and won big. By 2006, Mercedes contributed $6.8 billion to the Alabama economy, $1.2 billion in payroll earnings, 41,000-plus jobs, and $100 million in taxes. Now Mercedes is looking to move its corporate headquarters from New Jersey. Or is it? Is it just a ploy to get New Jersey to sweeten the incentive kitty and not risk losing the 1,000-plus jobs? We don't know. History tells us many of these projects are created to squeeze as much out of government entities in corporate tax breaks. But if Daimler CEO Dieter Zeitz really is interested in shopping for the HQ location, North Carolina officials need to go full force to lay out their case for such a project. In the 1990s, during the auto plant project, former North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt was all over the project and was trying to convince the site consultants at Fluor Daniel almost daily to get an upper edge on Alabama. We need a similar champion today. There are reports that Daimler folks are interested in the RTP area. They should. Most of the high-ranking Mercedes officials visited the area to check on schools, roads, and neighborhoods. If these local booster groups can only get them to come back to the area to visit our communities and talk to them about light rail, population growth, and the income strength, I think it's a better storyline. But somehow I feel we may be getting played. Reportedly, Mercedes-Benz USA also has Atlanta on its mind. Really? If they're serious about Atlanta, being interested in Raleigh does not compute. Different demographics, different brand, and for sure different workforce. If Atlanta is in play, Charlotte stacks up better. But as people who come from out of town and out of state after living in this area for 6 months, the Triangle has a different vibe. Mercedes is a most enormously valuable brand. And of course, all of this matters if the project is real. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.